Good morning. Before I start, I'm going to ask Ethan Miller to come up here and read a scripture. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8.
Starting verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramoth. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like the other nations." But the king was this thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel, when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." Then Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them out from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now listen to their voice, however. You shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them." So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him for a king. And the people said, "This thing will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you, and he will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots, and he will appoint himself commanders of thousands and fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. You will also take your daughters as for perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and the olive groves and give them to his servants, and he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will also take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we may also be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles."
Morning, everyone. Hey, does anybody need to jumper jacks before we start getting it warmed up? So I know that the question is that I have is, who is your king? I know that's kind of a question that's, you know, it's easy. Oh, everybody's saying, "Oh, Jesus is our king," you know, and it's kind of like saying, you know, "What's your favorite type of meat?" And beef is obviously the correct answer there. Let's turn back to Exodus chapter 3. And as we read through today, it might take a little bit as we might seem repetitious a touch, but we're going to read through some examples of the nations and what God did to them on the account of their gods. And so in Exodus chapter 3, we're going to start verse 16. This is God talking to Moses here, and he says, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, to the land flowing of milk with milk and honey. And they will pay heed to what you say. They'll pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met us. So now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness so that we may sacrifice to our Lord, our God, But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. Now I'll grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, and every woman who lives in her house, of articles of silver and articles of gold, clothing, and you will put them on your sons and your daughters. Thus you will plunder Egypt. So when God is telling Moses, and you know, it seems like it's a pretty easy thing to go forward and do. God's going to let Egypt go, and it's pretty smooth sailing, it looks like, at this point. But when God's saying there is that he's not going to let you go except under compulsion. Now, we need to make a point before we continue on. Let's turn over four chapters to chapter 7 of Exodus. And this is when Aaron's rod becomes a serpent here. In chapter 7 of Exodus, verse 8, it says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, works a miracle, then you will say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. And Pharaoh also called for the wise men and sorcerers, and they also, and the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. Each one of them threw down his staff, and it turned into a serpent. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staves. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said." So this Hebrew word for hardened here, it doesn't mean that God made Pharaoh do this. Okay, this Hebrew word for hardened is strengthening. So he's strengthening Pharaoh's heart. How Pharaoh's heart already was, the condition already was, he's just strengthening it. He's not making Pharaoh do something that he doesn't want to do. It's not like Pharaoh is this righteous guy, and oh, I was going to let the people go, but God is forcing him to do evil. So that's important as we go through this, and as we talk about the other nations and the gods and everything today, is that they're not forced to do this. It's what's in his heart already, and God's just strengthening that. Turn over to chapter 12. Jeff Eckerly gave me one of these things and bet me $5 that I couldn't eat it while I was up here, so I'm going to see if I can accomplish that. Exodus chapter 12. He also said I could do it pretty throughout the message, so I don't have to sit here and just eat it all in front. I can kind of go as you turn in pages there, so... Exodus 12, verse 12. Now notice how God, what he says here in verse 12, it says after there's been 9 plagues in Egypt already, and there's a 10th plague is coming. And in verse 12, he says, "Though for I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and strike down all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt, I'll execute judgment. I am the Lord." When you go through the 10 plagues, each of the plague at least dealt with one god of Egypt. And sometimes there are multiple. Okay, so God is attacking the gods of Egypt here. Okay, it's not necessarily that, I mean, the people are wicked too, but the gods of Egypt is what he's attacking. And the people are going to see the judgment as well. Turn this over to 2 Kings chapter 18. And we see here that the king of Assyria is mocking the Lord. And we start in verse 29. And Hezekiah is the king of Judah. This is when the kingdoms were split. Northern kingdom was Israel. The southern kingdom was Judah. And in verse 29, says, thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not deliver you from my hand, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. And thus, and this city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me and come out to me and eat each of his vine, each of his fig tree, and drink each of his water of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to the land like your own, and the land of grain and new wine, and a land of bread and vineyards, and land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die. But do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? So when he is... two more verses here. Getting ahead of myself. Where are the gods of Hamath, Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hannah, or Iva? Have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among the gods of the lands have delivered their land from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? So Sennacherib here is mocking God. He's telling the people, and he kind of makes kind of a sweet deal for him. Hey, I'm going to take you to the place, and you're going to have things there so you don't die. Hey, don't let Hezekiah deceive you, is what he's saying. He's all these other nations that went before, none of their gods delivered them. And why should the Lord deliver Israel? Turn over chapter 19 of 2 Kings there. In verse 32, this is after Hezekiah prays. He talks to Isaiah, and Hezekiah prays to God. And in verse 32 of 2 Kings 19, it says, therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come to this city or shoot an arrow there, neither shall he come before it with a shield, nor throw up a mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come to this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city, and I will save it for my sake, and for my servant David's sake. Then it happened that night that an angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And it came about that he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Arad. But Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. You see, it's a little interesting here that Sennacherib didn't die on the battlefield. He died in the temple of his God. When Sennacherib is going, he's saying, hey, you guys, there's no one's going to deliver you from my hand. None of the other gods delivered you, anybody else, from my hand. And so God destroys or kills Sennacherib in the house of his God. Okay, so his God was all powerful before, and the Lord wasn't going to deliver. And so Hezekiah prays. That's what Sennacherib said anyway. And then Sennacherib is destroyed in the house of his God by God because of his God. Turn to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. This is after the captivity, and after Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel's an old man at this time, and we all kind of know this story, but in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. And when Belshazzar tasted the wine and gave orders to bring gold and bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines might drink from them, Then they brought out the golden vessels, and they had taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the kings and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. And suddenly a finger of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall in the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand and that writing that it did. And skip on down to verse 22. We go through all this thing that he calls in Daniel. Well, he calls in all his wise men first, but then no one can give him the inscription or the translate it. And so Daniel comes in, and we get down to verse 22. He says, "Yet you, his son," and Daniel gives the explanation of how Nebuchadnezzar was raised up, and whoever he wanted to kill, he killed, and whoever he didn't, and so on. And in verse 22, he says, "And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this, but you exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought out the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you praise the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand, but the God in whose hand you are your life breath and your ways you have not glorified." And if we read on down a little further, we see that night the Medes and the Persians overtook Babylon. So again, we see the Babylonians fall on account of their God. They fell because now notice on all these things here, Egypt or Syria or Babylon, it doesn't just say that they were kind of coexisting doing their own thing, and the Jews were over here doing their thing, and it was all fine and dandy. It specifically says that they went against the Lord. So, and no matter what people say, false doctrines, which really is worshiping a false God, never can coexist with the truth. Yeah, they might last for a while, but they hate the truth. They're always against the true God. Turn back to 2 Kings 17. Now this is prior to what we read a little bit ago, and this is the account of why Israel fell. This is the northern kingdom that he's describing here now that he's talking about. In verse 6 of 2 Kings 17. "In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried Israel away into exile to Assyria and settled them in Hala and Habar on the river of Gazan and in the city of the Medes. Now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and have feared other gods. And they walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel which they had introduced. And the sons of Israel did things secretly which were not right against the Lord their God. Moreover, they built for themselves high places in all their towns, and from watchtowers to fortified cities. And they set for themselves sacred pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burned incense in all the high places, as the nations did which the Lord carried out to exile before them. And they did evil things, provoking the Lord. And they served idols concerning which the Lord has said to them, You do not do this thing. That the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and every seer, saying, Turn from your evil ways and keep the commandments and my statutes according to all with the law which I commanded your fathers, which I sent to you through my servants the prophets. However, they did not listen, but stiffened their necks like their fathers did, who do not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant, which he had made with their fathers, and his warnings, which he had warned them. And they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the nations which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to do like them. And they forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves molten images, even two calves, and made Asherah, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven, served Baal. Then they made their sons and daughters pass through fire and practice divination and enchantments, and sold themselves into evil in the sight, and did evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them none was left except for the tribe of Judah. Also Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked to the customs which Israel had introduced. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of the plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, he made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel away from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. And the sons of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from his sight, as he spoke through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day. See, Israel, you know, you think of the Israelites, the Jewish nation, they had the true God. But God destroyed them because of the false gods that they went after. See, notice it when you're reading through the reasons why God took them out, you don't see things. I'm not saying these didn't actually happen. He doesn't specify murder or theft or adultery or greed or coveting or anything like he doesn't specify that. Now, I'm not saying those things didn't happen. I'm just saying that because they worshipped, they went after false gods. I'm sure they did those things. But if they would have followed after the true God, they wouldn't have done those things. And lost my thought here. The sin that they committed was rejecting the true God. And because of that, God destroyed them. Now, what are false gods? I mean, is God really making a big deal out of just a statue? And I'm not saying if that was all it was that it wouldn't be a big deal. But let's turn ahead to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 for a second. And Paul writes about this a little bit here. First Corinthians chapter 10. We're going to start in verse 18. And Paul writes, "Look at the nation of Israel. Are those who eat sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or an idol is anything? No. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not God. And I do not want you to become sharers of demons." Now, it is true that it's rebellion against what God says to worship an idol, but it's not just merely an idol that they're worshiping. It's not an idol that they're sacrificing to. Paul says they're sacrificing. It's not that the idol's anything. It's not that the thing sacrificed, the meat sacrificed idol is anything. It's that they're sharers in demons. They're sacrificing to demons. The false gods that they're sacrificing to are demons. Those who rebelled against God. Now, when back in Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, when God said, "I'm going to execute the judgment against Egypt and against its gods," okay? So, and we even read in 2 Kings 17, where Israel, they worshipped the hosts of heaven, and they had Asherah underneath all the trees and so on. So all the false gods are, you could say, are really fallen angels. Which there's one fallen angel that's great, which is Satan. We understand that. And really, they're all, you're really worshiping Satan. There's not like, well, I'm not worshiping Satan, but I'm not worshiping God. I'm kind of in between. There's no in between. You're either worshiping God or you're worshiping Satan. Now, the question that I kind of wanted to bring up this morning, and it kind of worked that Phil and Matt both kind of set a pretty good stage for this message this morning, is what are the gods of the United States of America? You know, we kind of get the idea that maybe that America's good. You know, we're not that bad. We're not like the nations. We're not like the Israelites who worship different gods, or even, you know, they sacrificed their children. Well, do we sacrifice our children as a whole? I'm not saying everybody, but as a whole, does America sacrifice their children today to the God of freedom and my body, my choice? Phil alluded to it last night. And part of it, and when Phil was speaking last night, and he talked about the abortion issue kind of being, you know, as a decade, the last decade or whatnot. And in some ways, I had to kind of rethink of how big a stance I've made on it recently, like, or how maybe a little, because sometimes you kind of think, well, you know, we kind of beat that horse a little bit. And some of those thoughts maybe get in your mind, you know. But they shouldn't, you know. So let's put it this way. So I could say that I'm a father of seven. But you only see three kids over there, okay? Now, when people ask for how many kids you have, I'll say three kids. But actually, I have seven kids. So why isn't my answer how many kids you have? I have seven kids, four of them are in heaven, and I'm going to work to get these three there too. How come that's not my answer? Well, you know, that in some cases, you know, we might think, well, that's kind of a silly answer. But when we're training our thinking, and we're taking a stand for things, How come we're not referencing, because life does begin at conception, how come we don't address it that way? You know, if we, in some cases, maybe we think that, you know, I know I'm kind of picking on the abortion issue here a little bit, but we might think, well, you know, how far should we push that? But what kind of statement would that make if someone said, or if I would say, how many kids, if people said, how many kids do you have? Kirk, well, I have seven kids. Four of them are in heaven. Three of them are still here. See, and that perspective of the value of life. You know, we start thinking that, you know, we're as Americans, we're not really that bad. And so in Glendive, a few years back, there was the city council had voted to allow an adult entertainment facility to be allowed in the city limits. And where they were putting that, we were at a meeting, it was actually a Republican meeting, and some of the people were like, they were putting it kind of in the area of a Head Start program. Okay, which is basically government kindergarten or preschool. So the statement was made, and why would you put it next to Head Start? That's just horrible. And, you know, I don't know if I should have said it or not, but I said, I'm not sure what's worse, the adult entertainment or the Head Start program. So, I mean, it kind of caught some people off guard. They didn't really know what to say. But what is worse? In 5 years, they're going to teach that stuff to those kids anyway. Maybe not even 5 years. But we, you know, we think, oh man, that facility, that's no good. This Head Start, that's okay. It's the same thing. You know, nationalism isn't righteousness. And please don't take this the wrong way. I appreciate the men and women who have fought for our nation's freedom. Okay? But I saw a Facebook meme after those 13 soldiers got killed in Afghanistan. And it was a picture of Jesus hugging one of the soldiers, and it said, caption below, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Please don't send me hate mail, okay? If you do, I'm from Missoula. My name is Mark Miller. So you can just send it. But, okay. I'm not sure if that was correct. In fact, if I was a betting man, I might say that all 13 of those guys are in hell. Now, I'm not saying that to be mean, but as Americans, we get the idea that our guys are righteous, and their guys are the dirtbags, and they're in hell, and our guys are in heaven. All of our soldiers are in heaven right now. Is that the idea that is portrayed? That's not true. I'm not even going to say it's most likely not true, because it's not true. Not all, and I'm not saying that there couldn't have been a soldier that was righteous in there. Or I'm not saying that there hasn't been a soldier that has died that wasn't righteous. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we associate righteousness with Americanism and unrighteousness with everybody we battle against. What do you think about, like, so does that mean the Germans, we did fight the Germans, but, so when they're, does that mean there was nobody that was a Christian that died on the other side? I'm not saying there was, but that's the way we think, because we tie our freedom, we tie our nationalism into, well, we're a godly nation, right? Turn to Psalms. Psalm 31. Psalm 31, verse 5. Now, there's quite a few of the Psalms where you can, they're multifold. And so it might be David writing it. Psalm 22 is an example of that. But it's written about Jesus and the words that Jesus actually said. There's some evidence here in this psalm of Psalm 31. See in verse 5. "Into thy hands I commit my spirit. Thou hast ransomed, O Lord God of truth. Ransom me, O Lord God of truth. I hate those who regard vain idols, but I trust in the Lord." See, the Hebrew words there in verse 6 for vain means emptiness or vain. The Hebrew word for idol actually doesn't mean idol. It means vapor or breath. So what he's basically saying there is, I hate an empty breath or a false teaching. And not necessarily the false teaching. The word for those who regard, it means those who preserve or to keep or to watch over that false teaching. He's saying, I hate those who preserve the false teaching. Now, it's translated idol. I think, and if you have a King James, actually you have a lot better translation than the American Standard. I know I bit my tongue when I said that, But I actually think that'd be the New American Standard does us a little disservice by how they translate that word there. I'm not saying it's not an idol. I'm just saying you don't get the full picture, because he's not just saying about this little statue that he hates, or the people who preserve the statue. He's saying, I hate those who preserve the false teaching, the empty breath. Turn ahead to Luke 19. Did Jesus have to deal with that? Luke 19. In verse 38 of Luke 19, we see that it says, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." So we get the picture we're given here that Luke's writing about is the triumphal entry, as it's known, that Matthew and Mark write about as well. And if we skip down to verse 41. When he approached, he saw the city and he wept over it, saying, "If you had known this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days shall come upon you when your enemies will throw up a bank before you and surround you and hem you in on every side and will level you to the ground and your children within you. And they will not leave you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." What's Jesus saying here? Weren't they just saying glory to God in the highest? Glory to God in the highest. Peace in heaven. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Didn't they recognize him as king? They recognize him as king to their understanding and their desire, not how he was king truly. Because they were searching for the king that was delivering them from Rome, going to ride in on the white stallion and start up, build his army and go and wipe out Rome and wipe out all the other nations and restore the kingdom of Israel. That's what they were looking for. Yeah, he was king. They weren't wrong that he was king, but they thought he was a king in a different way than he actually was. And they didn't recognize it. Because the false teaching. When you go through in the New Testament, you don't see a lot, Jesus battling back against any idols that the Jews there are worshiping in a sense of the statue. But you have him battling back against the false teaching that they were keeping watch over and preserving. And that false teaching that they were keeping watch over and preserving led to their destruction. It was another idol, just as bad as an idol. It was another god, a false god. Now, is America like that? Hey, raise your hand if you've been to a funeral where they said this person's going to hell. I mean, you don't go to funerals where that. I mean, so does that mean? I know that there's people in America that are going to be in hell. I mean, the false teaching that we have here is they're preserving, just like Psalm 31 says, "I hate those who preserve and keep watch over the false teaching, over that idol, over the idol." Just like the Jews did it in the first century of they held on to that false teaching and they ended up being destroyed for it. You know, we might have to prepare for an America, or actually the lack of an America. Then the gospel still has to go forth. You know, we get the idea that, well, I'm going to, you know, stick to my guns and everything like that. You know what? Mr. Wilson did me a little bit of a favor last week. The bulletin for Bozeman had a picture of me preaching at Peaks. And I usually open carry anyway. It's just cold today. But so I didn't have to come strap on a couple of AR-15s up here to preach. It's funny to prove this point. So, but I have my share of guns, and I have them for a purpose. But if the National Guard is surrounding my house and says, "Give me your guns or you're going to lose your kids," you know, my decisions, I'm going to have to make a decision there. So math is logical. Let's approach this like a math question here. The state's coming to get your guns or get your kids, and you fight back against them, you're dead, Your wife's dead. I'm pretty sure they're not going to come to one of you guys and give them so you can raise them. Okay? Pretty sure that's not going to happen. So, in the case of, and again, I'm not saying that every situation is going to be the same, that you need to just go give up like nothing. I'm not necessarily saying that. I'm just saying you have to make the decision. You have to really make the decision, think hard about who your king is and where your kingdom is. Because if I have the opportunity to have no guns, but still can teach my kids, guess what opportunity I'm going to take? You know, I'm not going to open up another can of worms here, but I was anti-vaccine before it was cool to be anti-vaccine. Okay, kind of like Barbara Mandrell's song, that country song, I was country before it was cool, you know. I'm not quite a country. I've kind of expanded on my music listening, you know, and some more of the contemporary Christian. Burkina Country is pretty good, and the Wilson Boys got me on Need to Breathe. My dad's in this only, but Toby Mac's not horrible either. I was talking to Jason Nace the other day, and he said, "So Kirk, so when you listen to that, did you have like the hand motions?" And I'm like, "What hand motions?" You know. But anyway, so the COVID shot. I mean, obviously, there's people who I know that are pro-vaccine that don't like the COVID shot. And I'm kind of leaning towards the anti-vaccine side, so you can kind of tell I'm probably not liking the COVID shot. But if the case was, because I've read some of this stuff, read this, these situations happen, if the decision is COVID shot, or we're going to come take your kids, and you know what decision I'm making? Now, I'm not saying that it's good. I'm not saying that I like it. I'm not saying this to make some political statement. I'm just saying this to say I have my political beliefs too, but I got to make a decision sometime. If it comes down to it, my kids or do something that goes against my freedom, I'm probably gonna choose my kids over that so I can still teach them. Because the state's not going to teach them. If they're going to teach them, they're not going to teach them correctly. The state's going to put them in the Head Start program. It's just as bad as the, or maybe worse than the adult entertainment business. The beast is making war with the saints. Now, if you haven't checked it out before, Luke Wilson has a pretty good set of notes on the revelation of Jesus Christ. Everybody, you know, when they talk about, everybody asks about those books and they get and they tout, "Oh, I love this book," whatever. So I can do this a little bit here. Luke is probably has one of the best explanations that I've seen on the deal. So if you get a chance, I think it's on newcreation.us, go take a look at that. The beast's purpose is to make war with the saints. The governments of the world hate us because they're controlled by Satan. Turn to Romans chapter 12. A couple more verses here. I could pull Matt Hartford and say, one more verse, maybe another. Romans chapter 12. Verse 18, Paul writes, he says, "If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men." Okay, I understand that it might be sometimes impossible to be, you know, The beast system might just come down and they might take the guns and my kids as well. I'm not saying that's not an option, that's not a possibility. But as far as it's that I have control over, I'm going to try and live at peace with the government, if you will say. And the first century, put yourself in the situation of a Jewish Christian, for example, in the first century. Everything that they knew, their nation, was just about was going to be destroyed. And the writer of Hebrews writes to them to encourage them through this. But turn over to John chapter 21. And Jesus asked Peter a question. We know Peter, you know, the passion that Peter had, and you know, he was ready to destroy those people coming to arrest Jesus. He cut off Malchus's ear and so on, and he said, "You know, Lord, even if I have to die, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to fall away. I'm going to die with you." And Jesus said, "You're going to deny me three times," and so on. And the misunderstandings they had about, I mean, they weren't as bad as everybody else. They still had some misunderstanding about the nation of Israel. Notice how, what Jesus says here after this, after, you know, Peter kind of makes his move, so to speak. John 21, verse 15. After he was resurrected here, it says, "So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said to him, "Tend my lambs." Now, there's more to this that I'm not going to cover, because he can go and cover the why he asked three questions and all that good stuff. But he asked him a question. He said, "Do you love me more than these?" Now, the "these" could probably mean a few different things. But I'm assuming that the "then these" probably referred to his nation, or what he'd been taught about the Messiah coming and saving him from Rome. I think that's probably what was included. Are these physical things, "Do you love me more than these, Peter?" And I guess we probably should ask ourselves the question, do we love, I mean, it's easy to say, do we love Jesus more than this? Are we willing to go through the same thing, maybe not quite as extreme, but as a first century Jewish Christian was? I don't even like that term. The Christians that used to be Jews, it should be. Are we willing to go through that? Because it's possible that we might have no America. Are we just going to give up then? Or are we going to have a gospel to preach still? Are we going to prepare? Because really, I mean, there's persecution, and that's true. But this is a time of peace right now. I mean, we're not being held at gunpoint yet. Are we preparing right now for the time for a post-American world, post-freedom world? Are we preparing for that? I mean, it is possible. I think we read about a few things. It's possible to preach the gospel in a country that's not free, and in a country where you're always constantly on the run from somebody who wants to kill you. It's possible to do that. Are we ready to do it? Or are we too comfortable? Peacetime is for preparation. Do we love God more than our comfort?